This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Walter. Thanks for being with us. Feels like a couple of years now, but it's been less than 2 weeks since the midterm election ended. The story now, R&R. That's recounts and recriminations. In Florida, the writing was on the wall from the very beginning. Take a listen to Adam Smith, the political editor of the Tampa Bay Times, talking on this show the week before the election.
The great thing about Florida is these races are always so close. Tens of thousands of votes could make the difference. There are unlimited numbers of people to blame for losses and wins. And we've been doing that in Florida ever since the 2000 election.
And the echoes of 2000 can be heard loudly.
CNN announces that we call Florida in the Al Gore column.
Stand by. CNN right now is moving our earlier declaration of Florida back to the too close to call column. It's 2 o'clock Eastern time. CNN declares that George Walker Bush has won Florida.
We all know how that story ended, a final decision from the Supreme Court.
Seven justices of this court.
Seven justices here.
Have agreed that there are constitutional problems
with the recount.
Ordered by the Florida Supreme Court.
They're saying it's unconstitutional.
Effectively ending it here.
Since then, Florida ditched the old voting machines, so no more hanging chads. But once again, the state has found itself in an electoral mess. On Thursday by 3 p.m., all counties had to submit their machine recounts, but two counties fell short of the deadline. And Broward County missed the deadline by 2 minutes when a worker failed to upload the results in time. The process of uploading took 17 minutes. The worker started the upload at 2:45 p.m. From Democrats, the line has been, count all the votes.
I'm simply asking that every single vote that was legally cast be counted.
They're trying to shut down the election because they're afraid of the consequences if they don't. In other words, a Nelson victory. Every vote should be counted.
But Republicans say the prolonged process is akin to fraud.
I mean, it looks like they're going to do everything they can to steal this election. The reason why election lawyers get involved is to make sure as many votes as possible for their client is counted and as many votes as possible for their opponent is disqualified.
President Trump weighed in during a Daily Caller interview, saying without evidence that illegal voters, quote, go to their car, put on a different hat, put on a different shirt, come in and vote again, unquote. So where does all this rhetoric about elections being stolen leave the public's confidence in the process? Before the weekend, I spoke with David Smiley, political reporter at the Miami Herald, about what is wrong with Florida. WTF, what the Florida?
Well, Florida's electorate is really split, and that's why we are in overtime of the elections process. Top of the ticket races have, over the last three cycles, been decided by 1 point or less in elections where 6 million, and this year 8 million people have voted. And under our state laws, when the results are within a half of a percentage point, which they were for three races this year, three statewide races, it goes to this insane recount process, which obviously, you know, made Florida the butt of a lot of jokes 18 years ago and seems to be doing the same thing again. I guess the good news is it looks like we may be nearing the end of the process, unlike the 2000 elections, which happened under no real statewide guidance for what to do in recount situations and kind of went on a lawsuit-by-lawsuit basis. This time around, because of that election, we have laws guiding the process. I guess, fingers crossed, knock on wood, maybe we'll be done in a couple of days. But there are going to be some more legal decisions coming to see whether that's going to be the case or not.
So after the 2000 election debacle, changes were made that you're saying have actually made this process more efficient than it would have been had we seen Florida follow the rules pre-2000?
Yeah, I don't know if they've made it more efficient, but they've at least created deadlines to operate and have, you know, a sense of when things have to be done by. So I think we know that the recount process has been chaotic. It certainly exposed flaws or inaccuracies to some extent in some of the counting process under elections departments, which are all under a magnifying glass. And in South Florida, where the tri-county area of Palm Beach County, Broward County, and Miami-Dade has more than 2 million people casting votes. We've definitely seen questions about whether the recounts actually made the count less accurate, as vote tallies actually dropped in the numbers that were submitted or attempted to be submitted, I should say, yesterday, with Broward County missing a deadline by 2 minutes when their employee couldn't figure out how to navigate the state's website. So it's still been a muddled process, but at least this time around, there are laws saying what has to be done and when.
But given, David, given how many voters live in those counties, and as you said, we know that Florida elections are always really, really close, shouldn't Florida then expect that this kind of close race where we're going to have last-minute ballots coming in will be pretty normal, and they should expect to be able to handle this?
Yeah, I think that's a fair expectation. And in Palm Beach County, the election supervisor's machines, her tabulating machines, are old and were unable to handle the burden of rerunning hundreds of thousands of ballots after having just run them for the election. And I think that's an indictment on their planning. They apparently set aside $11 million to buy new equipment, but that was going to happen after this election. Bad decision, I guess, to wait. And Broward County, you know, Miami-Dade County seems to be doing fine, but Broward County also has had a bunch of problems. And yeah, I mean, given that all the people watching the process and involved in it seem to have a good sense that this was going to come down to close margins, it's not crazy to think that the election supervisors should have been better prepared, especially in Broward and Palm Beach.
Let's talk about Broward County. Brenda Snipes, who's the Broward County Election Commissioner, has been the target of a lot of the blame for this process. Does she deserve the blame?
Yeah, she does. As a human being, frankly, I feel bad for her. I feel bad for anyone who's sort of, you know, getting the ire of the entire country. And there's been a circus outside of her headquarters for about a week now. You know, there's no evidence that there's been widespread fraud in Broward County. We have all these allegations that there's ballot stuffing. And yet when the recount totals were attempted to be submitted, Bill Nelson actually lost more votes than Rick Scott lost. And so Rick Scott gained a couple hundred votes on him. And then suddenly the allegations from Republicans became that Broward County was intentionally not turning in its recount numbers to help Bill Nelson not lose those votes, which one thing is not like the other. So the arguments were changing. But on the other hand, Brenda Snipes has a well-documented history of problems, of either ignoring or not knowing about state laws and what her department could do. And she's done a very poor job of explaining from the jump what her department was doing and how many ballots were to be counted, why she had so many ballots coming in after Tuesday night when some candidates thought they'd already won, thousands of mail-in ballots that were being counted into the early hours of Wednesday morning after the election resulted largely in the governor's race going to recount and in a statewide agriculture commissioner race actually flipping from the Republican to the Democrat. And there are state laws that require Snipes and other election supervisors to report their numbers every 45 minutes, which she wasn't doing. She couldn't say how many ballots were left to be counted. And those are serious problems. She, you know, part of her job isn't just counting the ballots, but also ensuring that there's trust in the process. And she seems to have done a bad job on both counts.
Well, do you think that the integrity of the entire process in the state then has been undermined? And what do voters that you're talking to in the state, how are they going to process this going forward about trusting the state to accurately count the votes that have been cast?
I think the political rhetoric has undermined the process more so than the actual process itself. To have the governor of the state, without evidence, accuse election supervisors of massive fraud, to have the president making absurd claims that people are voting and then wearing disguises and coming back and voting again. These are people in prominent positions of power who are actively undercutting the elections process, and that's concerning. But yeah, I think voters here are really frustrated. There are thousands of voters who are learning now that, you know, maybe their votes were thrown out and now they have a chance to cure them, and they're trying to figure out How do they go and fix their signatures on their mail-in ballots and provisional ballots that caused them to be rejected in the first place? So, I think this is really offering a very acute window into some of the flaws of the process, or just some of the underbelly, maybe that's a strong word, but for the elections process in the state of Florida. And it's not quite as clean as everybody hoped it would be.
Yeah, David, that's a good point, which is part of it is this expectation setting. Some of it is done by the media as well, that election day is election day. And by the end of election day, we have an answer. Here's a winner and here's the loser. How much does that play into these allegations of fraud and the back and forth about who's trying or doing something nefarious? If we just told voters that, yes, this is election day, but it's going to take a long time to count all the different kinds of votes that come in, that maybe they would not feel as if there's something going wrong when we don't have an answer on election night.
I think that's a great point by you. And I do think that that is something that the media reporters have to own, that we absolutely do say, hey, it's election night, and we call the races. I had a story on Tuesday night after Andrew Gillum conceded, explaining how he lost, and horrifically by Wednesday night realized that he hadn't officially lost yet, and that there was a recount coming, and we had to have an internal debate about, well, he's probably not going to flip the race in the recount, so he's almost certainly going to lose, but he hasn't lost yet. You know, should we leave the story up? Do we take it down? We left it up because he was so far behind Ron DeSantis, despite the narrow margins, that he wasn't going to flip it. But we absolutely tell people that races are won and lost. I think we project that it's a Tuesday night, a one night affair. And obviously the deadlines for the unofficial results are several days later. And probably if we'd done a better job of explaining the amount of time that goes into actually counting all of the ballots, normally these things don't matter that much because the races are far enough apart that the stragglers, those last votes, aren't going to sway things one way or the other. But in this case, when they did, I do think the lack of explanation on how long the process actually takes fed into some of the insanity that's gone on around it.
David Smiley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
David Smiley is a political reporter at the Miami Herald. Coming up, we turn to the state of money in politics and find out who got the best return on investment for their midterm election donations. That's coming up. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast comes from Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. And you can too. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. Babbel users say they're amazed at how fast they learned and that they are confident in speaking their new language. Start learning a new language today. Just go to Babbel.com and use offer code TAKEAWAY to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L.com, offer code TAKEAWAY for 50% off your first 3 months.
Go to OmahaSteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to OmahaSteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Politics with Amy Walter, and we turn now to money and the midterms.
We have never seen this before.
We saw a $100 million race.
You raised $200 million.
Never seen so much money being spent of them attacked.
20s and 30s and 50s and even hundreds or whatever.
The most expensive midterm cycle that we've ever seen.
Most expensive ever.
Ever.
More than $5 billion was spent. and a big chunk of that money came from people like you.
Over $800 million came from small donors.
And that money made a big difference.
90% of the House and 91% of the Senate was won by the candidate who spent the most.
Sheila Krumholz is executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, where she tracks the money. And this year, the big money came from the left.
The Democrats boosted their fundraising and spending phenomenally. So they spent 44% more than they did last cycle. The Republicans were just up about 21% since 14. And they raised much more than the Republicans overall. So they outraised them by more than $300 million in the House and $144 million in the Senate.
And that seems kind of like a big deal, given that Republicans are the party in power.
Yes. The fundraising was telling, ultimately. Each cycle we say, record spending, record amounts of money, and the candidates that spend the most win. This time, the advantage went to the Democrats. So in 2010, when the Republicans took the House, the situation was reversed. They were the ones that were raising big and winning big. And this time it was the Democrats.
You and I, the last time we talked a lot about outside groups, but also some of these billionaire-funded outside groups. Is there any evidence that the Democratic billionaires were more successful than, say, the Republican billionaires, the Koch brothers, say, versus the Bloomberg super PAC?
Oh, yes. In previous cycles, 70% of the money was conservative in these outside groups. And the biggest donors giving to them were overwhelmingly Republican donors. This time, that is one of the most notable things, is that 54%, the majority of the outside spending, was by liberal groups. And only 30% was by conservative groups. So the reverse of the last three cycles, where conservative groups accounted for between 72 and 88% of the dark money spending.
Did the estimates you had on the role that outside groups would play in this election end up coming true?
Certainly, we expected the outside groups to remain important, and they have. What surprised us was that the proportion of dark money, that is money coming from non-disclosing nonprofits and LLCs, dropped.
And why do you think that there was a decrease in the dark money spending this year?
Well, there is, of course, some negative attitude about secret money.
Probably because you guys call it dark money.
Perhaps.
You think that has something to do with it?
Well, and by dark money, we just mean you can't see in the dark. So if we don't know the source of the money, we're in the dark about where it's coming from. And we think that's so critical because if you don't know where the money's coming from, you don't really know what's necessarily motivating the messaging it pays for. That bothers people. I think they recognize that, you know, people don't like to be tricked.
What does it say, though, whether it's a super PAC that's spending money in a Senate race in one state versus a donor who is writing checks to people who live not in their state or district? Is there a difference between that? I mean, if I'm writing $10,000 worth of checks and they're going to support people who don't live in districts anywhere near mine, is that an appropriate use of your voice?
Both are perfectly legal and legitimate. Many people think that donors should not be able to give to candidates they can't vote for. It bothers them that there are these outsiders meddling in my district, in my state, when they don't know the issues and the interests of our state. But it is important in the sense that, again, these donors are expressing excitement about candidates. They're inspired by their message. Even if they can't vote for them, they want to help them. And that's money in the candidate's campaign that they may need to get their message out to those who can vote for them. And ultimately, it supports candidates that may have a future in politics beyond this one race.
And how hard is it, do you think, to keep lower-level donors, smaller donors, engaged in the process election to election? It seems to me that a lot of the money that's in politics is from sort of habitual donors, whether they're billionaire types or just people who will write $2,500 checks. Is there any evidence that you have seen that once you engage in a process, even as a smaller donor, you're more likely to stay involved as a donor?
My sense is that people who give to campaigns that win are energized by that success and excited to put their money to work next time as well. So we'll see whether those donors step up to the plate again in 2020, but I would bet on it because more people are more engaged in presidential election cycles than in midterms. And I have to say, you know, all of these trends and patterns in spending and victories, we're in a new landscape in campaign finance and in electoral politics. There are just so many issues coalescing, and it's hard to pick apart which ones are most important or transcendent. But you can't look at this race and all of the new candidates and diversity of candidates and new donors and small donors without seeing the larger theme of a reaction to the 2016 presidential election. So my own guess is that we're going to see a continuation of that energy heading into 2020. And in fact, you know, the fundraising is already well underway for 2020, more than ever before. And I am sure that those who gave this cycle are already getting those solicitations now.
Sheila Krumholz, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sheila Krumholz is Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics. One of the major takeaways about money this election season was the impact of small-dollar donors using platforms like ActBlue. Here's Sheila Krumholz again.
Well, ActBlue is just pervasive as the go-to platform for Democratic candidates and PACs and parties, you know, affiliated with Democrats, being able to rely on these online donations, you know, that's a significant advantage for them.
So I sat down with ActBlue's executive director, Aaron Hill, to learn a bit more about their philosophy.
Small dollar fundraising has been growing, particularly as a portion of the left over the course of the past few election cycles. And we have seen folks using our platform and tools over the past three elections to double the amount of money that they were raising for different candidates and causes through our platform. This particular election cycle, from the beginning of 2017 till now, millions of folks have used our platform to donate $1.6 billion.
Wait, hold on. Rewind. So this election year, just this election, mm-hmm. donors went through your site to donate $1.6 billion.
Yes, they used an ActBlue fundraising form to donate $1.6 billion to Democratic candidates or organizations or nonprofits that were using our platform, with an average contribution size of about $40. So that's a lot of donors having a lot of impact. And we've seen this growing for the past few elections. This is about double the volume that folks raised through our platform in 2015 and 2016. And so we've seen this kind of progression over the past elections, but obviously those are some eye-popping numbers. And we have seen engagement this past 2 years that we just haven't seen before. And I think there are a few things that can be attributed to that. First of all, the climate in the country and people's feelings about the Trump presidency and what is going on in this country has really activated this whole new kind of surge of civic engagement across the country. And we're seeing this manifest not only in donations, but also in people who are marching, other kinds of activism. They're calling their representatives. They're going to protest. They are making their voices heard. There were all of these stories about how Democrats were fielding more candidates, not only at the federal level, but all at the state level than ever before. And we saw genuine excitement from small dollar donors to support these new voices, to help people who may not have been part of a traditional donor network be able to get their message out there and to not only kind of reclaim both the House of Representatives, but also these state legislative chambers and have these wins for Democrats, but also to change who was running. I think that that was very successful in terms of the results. That small dollar donors invested in and that we see continually happening still since last Tuesday.
For those folks who've never been on your website, can you help us understand how it works? If I said, boy, I'm really interested in donating to a candidate, but I don't know which candidate I want to donate to. I'm really fired up. Do I just log into your portal and you tell me who to donate to and I write the check to them? How does it work?
So ActBlue builds online infrastructure for the left. We're a nonprofit. Our entire mission is to make it possible for small dollar donors to have their voices heard. And so we build all of this fundraising infrastructure and these software. And we're used by a number of candidates and committees, pretty much everybody on the Democratic side. People could go to our website. They could enter people's names in our directory and pull up their contribution site and make those contributions. But that's generally not the way that people will encounter us. Mostly campaigns and organizations will use our tools. As part of the small dollar programs that they're building, they're making these connections with these small dollar communities. So maybe you heard about a candidate that you like and you go to their website and you click the contribute button. Oftentimes, you'll get an ActBlue form. Maybe you are on an email list and you're getting messages from a campaign or an organization that you're supporting, and you read that message and say, yes, I want to be part of this, and you click the button to make a contribution, oftentimes that will take you to an ActBlue form. So we see it as our job to make it really easy for donors to connect with the campaigns and committees that they need, and to make it possible for all campaigns and committees to have the best fundraising tools they need so they can grow these grassroots communities and really be people-powered.
Erin, what do we know about the actual donors who are using ActBlue? Are they first-time donors?
Yes, and I think that that's one of the more exciting things. We saw this election cycle. So we saw about 5 million unique donors over the course of 2 years, and about 60% of them were donors we hadn't seen before at ActBlue. And that's kind of saying something because we've been central Democratic infrastructure for, as you said, since 2004 now. So we had seen a lot of Democratic donors already. But this particular election cycle brought a lot of new people into the process, which was really exciting, particularly because our job is we try to make it easier for these donors to be able to kind of interact with the causes that they care about. So when people come and donate via us, they can save their donor information in something we call ActBlue Express accounts that lets you save your employer and occupation and your credit card information. And once you do that, you can give to any of the candidates or causes that use ActBlue tools by just selecting an amount and making a contribution that way to make it really frictionless for small dollar donors.
How many people did that, that set up an Express account and then you contribute to anybody all over the country?
So we have about 6 million people who save their information and donate that way. Again, with the idea of making it really frictionless, it's the campaigns and committees and small dollar donors that are doing the really important work here. Campaigns and organizations are building these small dollar communities and they're working with these constituencies and their members right from the ground, involving them in all their decisions. And so if those folks are forming a connection with a donor and a donor says, yes, I support this message, or yes, I want to be part of it, we want to respect that donor's time and make it as easy as possible for them to make those contributions. And so ActBlue Express is a huge way to do that, particularly as we see about half of our contributions now coming from people using a mobile device. And there is no worse user experience than trying to type in 16 digits of your credit card number with your thumbs on your phone. So whatever we can do to make that an easier process for donors, we see it leads to more participation, which leads to more people kind of backing these candidates, which leads to a democracy run by the many and not just the few billionaires.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you is, do you see yourself as a direct competitor to these super PACs that are out there now?
I mean, small dollar donors are a direct competitor, I think, to the idea that only a few rich people can fund contributions, particularly in this era past Citizens United. Small dollar contributions are just good politics. We want a democracy that's actually democratic and where the many people are choosing who can run and which candidates can be viable and not just a few. But also, it's good strategy. It means small dollar donors don't cap out and don't hit their max amount in the same way that a large donor would. So you can kind of keep building that relationship and keep talking to them as your campaign is growing, as your policies are evolving, and keep in touch. And it means that the money is going right into campaigns. And campaigns can spend money in a different way than, say, like a super PAC could. So campaigns can buy ad time at a discounted rate. They get to know what their message is, and they get to know their strategy, so they know where they're spending their money.
So what happens next? There was obviously a tremendous amount of energy this year among Democrats to go and take control of the House. They succeeded there. Do you think all the energy that you saw in 2018 continues through to 2020? And I'm thinking specifically for some of these down ballot candidates who now are going to have to compete with presidential campaigns. You know, in 2018, the House was where all the cool kids were. 2020, the cool kids are running for president.
Well, I think it's only going to continue and to grow because, as you note, our work is not done. There are a bunch of elections currently still going on. There are runoffs that are going to be happening. 2019, there are a lot of local elections, and there are state elections in places like Mississippi. And then, as you point out, we're going into the 2020 Democratic presidential primary, and I think small-dollar donors are going to be the most important constituency there.
Erin Hill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Amy, for having me.
Erin Hill is Executive Director of Act Blue. And we've been hearing from many of you who were inspired to donate this year.
Hi, this is Kristen from Hamilton, New Jersey.
Hi, my name is Joe Martin from Fort Collins, Colorado.
Hello, my name is Carol. I'm calling from Los Angeles, California.
Hi, this is Stephen Fricke from Arlington, Texas.
Yes, I donated to a political candidate in the midterms.
Very important to support other candidates. There's a bigger picture and more at stake.
I'm pretty satisfied with every penny my donation.
While Act Blue's success is worrying many on the Republican side of the aisle, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who reportedly raised the issue to donors shortly after the election, that anxiety is somewhat misplaced, at least according to Patrick Ruffini, a Republican strategist and co-founder of Echelon Insights.
I personally don't believe, as a Republican, that this is a platform problem. I think this is a motivation problem. Republicans were, in this election cycle, on the defensive virtually the entire election cycle. And, you know, even though I think their voters were motivated, fairly motivated to come out and vote in the end, given the historic turnout we saw in the election, Democrats were even more motivated. And certainly from a small dollar perspective, I've seen the highs, I've seen the lows. I was around and, you know, I helped a lot of candidates raise small dollar donations online in 2010. And I saw the power and, you know, just the power of the enthusiasm and the motivation in that cycle. And that just wasn't here this cycle just because of, you know, the nature of the political cycle.
And how much of that, too, is that the driving force on the Republican side is President Trump, that he takes all of the oxygen? And when it comes to 2020, is he also going to take the dollars from small
right.
donors, that they're much more interested in saying, I support the president. They're not as interested in saying, but we need to keep the House or we need to win in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're going to see it on both sides. Everything's going to refocus on the presidential election. I do think President Trump shows that Republicans overall do not have a problem with small donors. He has broken records for Republicans and small donors. In fact, they never really shut down their campaign because they realize, you know, it's better to raise money using President Trump as the calling card. But I think there's something missing in that process, because even though that money may flow to like the Republican National Committee, and the Republican National Committee can then write checks to the other Senate and House campaign committee arms, right? I mean, which they will do and they have done. You don't really have, I think you've really had over a number of years on the left, through sites like Daily Kos, through a number of different resistance groups that have popped up in the last year, just a culture of talking about down ballot races, talking about state legislative races, talking about secretaries of states and the issues of voting rights and voter registration. So you have this sort of inside baseball conversation that I don't think quite happens in the same way on the right. I think on the right, folks are more focused on maybe combating bias in the media. You know, that's sort of the your hobby horse, let's say. Yeah, as a result, you don't maybe get this necessarily the same hyper-local focus, even just removing the enthusiasm question.
You know what else was striking to me, Patrick, was the fact that these donations were not about ideology. It was just really simply about winning, which to me is a big change in the ways in which small donors get engaged in politics, right? Usually they get engaged in politics because they are attracted to the policy or the ideology, the person. This was just, I'm writing checks because we need to take back the House. I don't care who these people are, what
right.
they stand for. If they can win, they're getting money from me.
I think that's partly true, right? When you have a very charismatic candidate like Beto O'Rourke,
right.
you know, that helps, right?
Right.
And I don't maybe think that Phil Bredesen got as much money in the Tennessee Senate race from online donors because he actually did have to take some more conservative positions to appeal to the electorate in that state. But there's sort of an interesting question of how far does this go? So after Heidi Heitkamp voted against Brett Kavanaugh, there was a flood of over $10 million in online donations into a state, a very small state like North Dakota, where there's only so many ways you can spend that money. And she lost by double digits. I think to the extent that, you know, people were really using fundraising figures into the forecast models and really kind of using that as a gauge of Democratic enthusiasm. And I think you have to temper that a little bit with there's an emotional aspect to this as well that can't be overlooked.
Let's walk this out then to 2020 and what your expectations are there. What role do the parties, if at all, now play in helping to finance candidates and the sort of infrastructure that you need to run campaigns?
Candidates are more and more have the opportunity to finance themselves and build an independent power base outside of the party. So they're not as dependent upon political parties anymore. I think that that is sort of a thing of the past, that the parties have kind of more and more, even on, I'd say it's true on the Republican side and even more true on the Democratic side, where the party has been completely absent from a lot of the traditional party building features. But the party sort of plays a very back office role, doing data analytics, writing checks to where it's needed, but not really kind of propping up candidates in the same way. Candidates are, I think, expected to bring to the table their own fundraising prowess.
So are you concerned as a Republican going into 2020, looking at not just the presidential, but let's look down ballot, where a lot of this money from Act Blue was going, that there is not a sufficient answer to it yet?
I think it all depends on enthusiasm and what enthusiasm is going to look like in 2020 as compared to 2018. If it's 2018 redux, we have this huge enthusiasm gap, and I think that may actually be partly, I don't think it could be quite as bad for Republicans, but it may be partly as bad. I think certainly we're going to have many Democrats running for president who are going to steal a lot of potential online oxygen and donations. And I do think that any excess capacity that House candidates are able to siphon off from the presidential race, I do think the presidential race will be Armageddon. So it's very hard to say. But I will say, again, even with less focus on down ballot elections overall, the fact that Democrats have built, I think, a culture and an infrastructure around just focusing, talking at the grassroots level about some of these local races, which I don't think quite exists on the Republican side, even regardless of the technology. There are a number of really great Republican fundraising technologies. A lot of people have kind of duplicated the functionality of Act Blue, but I don't think there's the same connective tissue. We're going to direct the fire hose of donations because you have a conservative media ecosystem that's largely focused on other things. Fox News isn't really talking about, well, there's this really great candidate running in this seat. And, even though he's not the most conservative candidate, he really has a chance to win. Right. You'd never see that kind of conversation happening on a conservative media platform.
Patrick Graffini, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Graffini is a Republican strategist and the co-founder of Echelon Insights. The races for state's attorneys general also raked in quite a lot of money this election season. Estimates are $100 million. And the reason these races drew so much dollar power?
You can't sue the federal government directly, so this makes the AGs a funnel for all national organizations who have issues with whomever is the president and the president's administration.
That's James Tierney. He served as the Attorney General of Maine from 1980 to 1990. And since Donald Trump took office, state's attorneys general have been on the front line of taking on the administration. They've sued over withholding of health care subsidies offered under the Affordable Care Act. They sued over the Muslim ban, family separation, access to contraceptives, and a slew of environmental regulations. And following the midterm elections, Democrats picked up 4 more attorney general seats, making their total 27 of the nation's 51 offices. And that means we could see a lot more activity from this group opposing action out of the White House. But how did it get this way?
with states' attorney general given the power to sue the federal administration. James Tierney explains.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court in 2006 gave the states the special right to sue the federal government when other organizations can't. But the real reason it's happening is because of the integration of our economy. All of us buy things on the internet, right? So this means that even the smallest state attorney general has jurisdiction over some pretty big corporations. And then when you have the overall coarsening of our political environment where, you know, everybody goes to ground, the Republicans and Democrats, then you get the hostility against whatever administration's in power, and it gets a lot of national attention.
How much attention, then, are these normally what I think of as low-key offices getting from national donors? Are they getting as much attention, as much money as, say, governors or senators?
Well, some of us have thought AGs were important for a long time. you remember the tobacco cases were brought and started by the small state of Mississippi. So that was a classic example of a small state being overlooked by gigantic interest groups. No one is overlooking attorneys general today. And so as a result, there are massive amounts of money in our Citizens United world that are flowing into AG races.
Do we know how voters in states are reacting to this? Again, there was a time in which I think most people expected that their state attorney general would be sort of the top lawyer for their state, not someone who was going to be active in sort of the national picture. Is that changing?
It's very interesting. There's no question that the legal community and the business community and the advocacy community have changed their views about attorneys general. But if you're talking about the average person, not so much. And as long as the attorney general is doing a good job on their day-to-day work, not their big national work, but their day-to-day work, defending the state, making sure that state agencies operate in a legal fashion, I don't think they notice. So attorneys general almost always get reelected. It's very rare that an incumbent's defeated, short of a scandal. There was one incumbent defeated this year, that's all, in Wisconsin. All the other incumbents in both political parties were reelected.
And yet Democrats did pick up a number of AG offices. They must have been in places where there were open seats. Can you talk about any of those?
It was a good day for the Democrats in 2018 when it comes to attorneys general. The Democrats picked up four seats, Nevada, Colorado, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And especially focusing on Colorado and Wisconsin, those are very sophisticated offices, and I think you'll see a real step up of activity. In Minnesota, Congressman Keith Ellison became the attorney general, and there's no question that there will be a great deal more activism coming out of the state of Minnesota. So if you're looking for more blue state activism, the voters gave that a very big green light.
Where do you think this activism will be focused most specifically?
Well, I think in two categories. I think the blue AGs will continue to, fight back against President Trump, and the red state AGs will continue to defend him. But I also think you'll see a big step up in civil rights and consumer protection. The blue state AGs are significantly increasing the size of their staffs. States such as New Jersey and Washington, along with California and New York, have really added on staff to do consumer protection and affirmative litigation, including environment. But they also the quality of the staff is very high. A lot of young lawyers who perhaps in the past would have wanted to work for the Department of Justice are saying, I can lead a better life and I can do more good if I go back home. And I see my students very anxious to work in AG offices that are increasingly competitive.
Hmm. And is there a particular topic? You've talked about the environment a lot. Do you think that's a topic in which we're going to see blue state AGs sort of bond together and bring up more lawsuits against this administration?
Well, the blue state AGs are already challenging. They challenge just about everything their former colleague Scott Pruitt tried to do. So there are dozens and dozens of environmental administrative law cases. But I am personally more hopeful that the attorneys general focus on the actual environmental degradation in their own state, because as the federal government walks away from clean water and clean air, it's up to the attorney general to say, you know, people want clean water. They want clean air. And I would hope the state AGs would not just focus their energies on suing the president. I do know the new attorney general of Michigan is very focused on in-state environmental issues. Same in Minnesota. They're worried about their lake quality and they can't go to the federal government for protection anymore. So they're going to have to do it.
Now, there are associations for each one of the party attorneys general. There's a Republican group and there's a Democratic group. Are they also becoming more active in helping to sort of shape the focus? And are these groups then helping to organize these battles?
Well, they're both an asset and a liability to every attorney general. Because the races are so expensive, no attorney general can run their races only with money that they raise within their own state. So because they're national offices, they have to turn to their national organizations to raise money, and that becomes an asset. Now, having said that, are they a potential problem? Absolutely, because people who give money usually want something back. And so they provide pressure points through these two organizations, the Republican and Democratic AGs associations, to get access to try to persuade their attorneys general to do something or in some cases not do something. But it's something that requires careful monitoring and transparency. And I've always argued that substantive legal decisions should never be made at a Republican or Democratic AGs meeting. You don't care whether you have a Republican or Democratic attorney general if you can't drink your drinking water, right? You want the problem solved.
So do you think that the attorneys general of this era compared to your era, they are much more focused on their national profile?
Well, they're focused on national issues because we all are. We can't sit down and buy a Christmas present without going on the internet, and that makes us national players. So they are focused on that because that's how American consumers live their lives now. We don't go down to the corner pharmacy, and if we do, the form of pharmacy is probably Walmart. So we're all playing in a national field, and so the AGs should pay attention to that.
Jim Tierney, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
James Tierney is the former Attorney General for Maine and founder of stateag.org. Okay, so I have some final thoughts. One reason the voters are confused and frustrated by the post-election vote counting process is that the media has created unrealistic expectations about how vote tabulating works. The cable news networks in particular have designed their sets, their coverage, and their promos depicting elections like a Super Bowl game, where one team is declared winner by the time the night is over. Except that's not how it works. More and more people are casting ballots by mail, and voters sometimes fail to show up on official logs at a polling place. They can still cast ballots, but their votes need to be verified. All of this takes time. Nothing nefarious or illegal about it. So if we want to help restore faith in the voting process, one of the easiest things we can do is to have the media stop treating election night like Super Bowl night. That's all for us today. Remember, you can always find us on Facebook, leave us a comment there, or send us a tweet. I'm at Amy E. Walter, and the show is At The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Amy Walter, and this is The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. It helps us in ways you can't imagine. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter and they'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.